So today, I wanted to speak about a topic which, if you're looking on the player, is titled Pure versus Distorted Energy. Now, all of us are, of course, as we all know, by our natures, pure energy. And that pure energy is basically characterized by our being. We saw over the last few weeks a very interesting six-part series from HBO called Angels in America. And it was about the beginning period when AIDS was just starting in America and people were starting to deal with it. They were starting to become more aware of homosexuality and all of the difficulties that people were facing in this world when they got sick. Well, one of the aspects of this show was when the people who were affected very deeply by this were being approached by angels, especially the main character in the show. And these angels they had a philosophy which, although not accepted as the main theme of the show, actually impacted me very deeply as far as its relevance and as an indication of a very serious problem that we all face in the modern world. They were saying that advancement, motion, movement, all of this which we take for granted in the world as our business in this world, are the cause of all problems. That actually just simply being, just simply existing in the pure energy is the only solution to anything in this world. They brought up the point that according to the books, they used to speak about the books. It was, of course, a bit of a satire on modern religion. But they were saying that according to what is written, there should be no changes. Everything should remain rather static. Everything should remain as it was. And that the real problems, all of the disturbances that exist in the world, come from this constant desire to move, to change, to be active. Because all of this change and activity creates cumulative effects which create situations like disease or catastrophes or terrorism or financial collapse and so on. The idea being that as soon as there's a transformation of state, immediately all kinds of difficulties come due to that transformation. Whereas if you keep everything static without this constant transformation, then there's a stability there. There's a peacefulness there. There's a closer connection to one's beingness. The idea that as soon as you have to move, as soon as you have to change, that you set into motion a sequence of events which will create long-term consequences is very real. It's a very practical conception. And the concept that static situation of remaining in one's position without trying to create any changes or transformations is actually a very secure position. Yes, this makes sense too. So while I was watching this, I said, yeah, that's it. That's the solution. The idea of moving, the idea of motion, the idea of change and transformation, throw this out. Let's just stick to being and forget about any activity whatsoever, and all the problems will be solved. You may have had the experience that when you hear something or you see something very inspiring and it makes a lot of sense and it really answers a lot of questions, that you immediately want to accept it and just embrace it and say, yes, this is the answer to everything I've been looking for. However, at the end of the show, the hero, who was considered a prophet, says that, well, no, I'm not interested in this solution. It's just not real. It's not me. I mean, after all, I'm a person. I've got desires. I've got to do something. I've got to act. And above all, I have to have love for others. I've got to interact with others in this world. Now, both of these points have great validity, and I'd like to discuss them a little more, and then go into this main concept of energy and its distortions. And I'll use the example of simple living and high thinking as a way to describe this a little bit more. Now, there is a certain beauty in the concept of simple living because you don't get involved in complicated things, you don't get entangled in complicated situations, you don't have to endeavor very much for things which are not really required. You can live off the land, have the food you need to eat, and live peacefully. And think of spiritual thoughts and listen to spiritual subjects and be happy. Now, this is certainly an interesting concept. It's one that used to work quite well, perhaps, in the past. And it's one which attracts the mind. However, it's also one which is a little bit, or shall we say, extremely impractical for people at the present age. First of all, we are not simple people. Very few are living off the land or have had any contact with the land at the present moment. From our birth, from our training, from that which we have been exposed to, we are involved in complex things. The very fact that we are having such discussions via the internet to places all over the world simultaneously is a testimonial to the fact that simple living is just not something we do. Such kind of living very much depends on localization, that everything you need, everything you do is within your local village or local area and not further than that. Yet here I am on my screen looking at Buenos Aires and St. Petersburg, Russia, Argentina and Russia. I mean, you could not find two places further apart in this world. In Argentina, they're cold right now, and in St. Petersburg, they're all boiling. The very techniques, the very technology we are using, the computers we are using, the cameras, the billions of miles of fiber optic cables and satellite connections that connect the whole world, none of this is simple. The political climate is different. The economic climate is different. The cultural climates are different. The media is something that never existed before. It's a totally new situation. So the idea of going back to a static situation of simplicity is not only impossible, it's absurd. Now, I am not saying that this situation will remain that we have presently. It can change radically at any moment. Certainly, that's possible. And when it does change radically, it will, of course, create a situation where we'd have to re-examine all of the assumptions that we have made in the present time. Because all of these assumptions are based on a very particular set of circumstances that we have now. These are not eternal, just as the simplistic circumstances of the past were not eternal. Therefore, to base a philosophy on changelessness is not very practical. Not only is it impractical, but it just doesn't work in any way, because change is the nature of the energy within which we live. Now, naturally, this energy of change is something difficult to deal with. It's a challenge that always puts itself before us and demands attention. Just think about the way in which our biological forms are growing and meeting different hormonal changes meeting different situations which are new and different and challenging and perhaps even destructive. These biological changes, these biological situations, these biological difficulties, these are things which you have to accept. They are just simply part of life. They are something which come to you. They are not something which you want to happen. And the situations of interrelationship between people and families and countries and economic communities and businesses forces all the time, that we change, that we deal with the new situations, that we adapt and adjust. Kamala Mala, please send me your video. I don't get your video, okay? So, it is very interesting when you think about it that even though the concept of simplicity is a beautiful concept, it is one which is very difficult to grasp. It has within it assumptions which the real world, which do not relate to the real world of today. It's just like if somebody was very stressed, somebody was very disturbed in their mind, in their heart, and you come up to them and say, "Don't worry, be happy." Now, naturally, it sounds good, it feels like it's something good, but in reality, it means nothing. If the only thing you had to do to make somebody depressed become not depressed is tell them not to be depressed, we wouldn't need psychologists, we wouldn't need hospitals, we wouldn't need therapy, we wouldn't need anything. To simply say, do it like this, doesn't work. There has to be a systematic methodology by which anything can be accomplished. Now, there has to be a systematic methodology in all respects to accomplish anything. Yes, thank you. It is not possible to do things simply on good intentions alone. There has to be building. You have to start off with a foundation and build upon that foundation. It is essential that we learn a technique or we have some assistance to actually get where we're going, not just good intentions. There has to be something practical. So here we see very clearly the conflict. In fact, I would say it's practically an eternal conflict between pure energy and energy in its distorted forms. Now, pure energy works quite well just as a being. It's very comfortable in its state of being. However, pure energy also has desire. Pure energy is also made of love. Pure energy wishes to be of service in that love. For example, let's say you love somebody. Naturally, how do you express that love? Of course, you can send out feelings of love. That you cannot do all the time. You express that love by doing things for that person, by giving them gifts or by doing things for them to make themselves more comfortable or more happy or giving them a thrill or giving them excitement in their lives. Mothers do that with their children as the children learn to grow, because children require stimulation. Children require challenges which make them expand their consciousness and awareness. Couples who love each other nourish each other, but also stimulate each other by challenging each other to do things in a better way so they can become greater versions of themselves. So love encompasses much more than just a feeling. It manifests in actions which basically are where you desire to be of service to others. There are more aspects to pure energy which are not so direct and simple and, shall we say, ideal. Even within the purest love, there is sometimes this feeling of jealousy, like, oh no, somebody's going to take away my lover, or feelings of, you know, not being peaceful, like feeling you're not being respected or not being accepted, or somehow or another, there's always some agitation in love that appears periodically. Now, sometimes these natural aspects of spiritual love can be distorted. But while they're not distorted, they formulate the basis of a spiritual practice. They formulate the basis of anything which is of a spiritual nature. And if you read the literatures of Rupa or Raghunath Goswamis or other Goswamis, you can find out different aspects of that pure love and how that pure love manifests in the spiritual realm. Now, I'm sure there is much more that can be said about these subjects, much more that many more ways in which that love can manifest, even beyond those particular, not beyond, but even alongside with those particular descriptions. But those descriptions give a very clear and a very interesting and intricate description of the ways of love, even pure spiritual love. It's intricate. Now, when you are in a situation where that is the where such kinds of spiritual, energetic environments are the guiding principles or the governing principle upon all activities in the world, it's easy to maintain a certain standard of undistorted spiritual energy. But when one is placed in another situation, that is not very easy to do. In fact, it becomes increasingly harder. When we who live here in this material universe have to deal with the situations which are around us, that pure energy naturally adapts to these situations. This adaptation is not something that you can do voluntarily or reject to do if you feel like doing it. It's something which you simply have to do to exist. Adapting to your circumstance and surroundings is a simple response of all living energy. When you are surrounded by pure, non-distorted spiritual energy, you adapt to that. When you are faced with another situation, you have to adapt to that. There's just no choice. Living entities adapt. That is the nature of a living entity. Just like we adapt to our changing bodies, we adapt to the change of time from day to night, we adapt from winter to summer, we adapt all the time. That's just part of our living energy. Without the capacity to adapt, you simply die. That's all there is to it. If you cannot adapt to different situations, then you don't really have the capacity or the qualification to live. Now, because you're forced to adapt, that doesn't mean you are somehow or another unqualified, of a lower quality, dull and materialistic, or any of these negative connotations. It simply means you're in another situation which is less than ideal for maintaining a static state of non-distorted spiritual energy. Yet, let's think about the good aspects of this requirement to adapt, because there are many good things about that too. If you think about it in your own life, haven't you made the most advancement? Haven't you made the most growth when you were challenged by some situation? We have seen that in times of crisis, like when there's an explosion or there's a catastrophe or something like this, people come together and do things together to help each other that ordinarily they would never do, with such feelings of love and companionship and service, which are just wonderful. When we are challenged like that, it brings out really great qualities in each of us. Because These challenges become the impetus for transformation, where you're faced with a choice that will not go away, to either do nothing and perish, or do something and help not only yourself but others. Now that is a very important point that all of us have to, shall we say, face in our lives at one point or another, if not multiple points in our lives. Sometimes we accept static energy. We just want to keep everything the same. We don't want to change anything. So we engage in some formula of life that we can depend on and do the same thing all the time without being faced with the energy of transformation. But the world is not like that. And periodically, we are faced without our own desire. We are forced to accept transformation. We are forced to accept a situation which so challenges us that we have to make a change. Now, these forced transformations, they are, shall we say, arranged by higher authorities to make us grow. Part of our arrangements before we take birth in this world are our desires, our intentions to grow beyond those, shall we say, hindrances, stumbling blocks, or to grow beyond those static states which kept us from transforming in the past. These states prevented us from making some moves, from making a transformation, from doing something which we really ought to do in our lives. I've seen in my life, I mean, I can really speak with experience, that when I become complacent, when I think everything is fine just the way it is and I'm going to muddle my way through life. You know the word muddle? It means just kind of like, you know, go through without any challenge whatsoever. Just, you know, average your way through life. Then something very significant comes to just blow that to pieces. Somehow or another, I mean, this is my idea, I feel that this is some arrangement I have also shared in the creation of before I took birth in this lifetime. I know that I'm somebody who rises to challenges, rises to occasions, who when everybody else is freaking out, I become very calm. That's just my nature. Each and every one of us have a situation which challenges us, which inspires us, which gives us an impetus to grow, which is unique to our particular energy. I don't think these challenges and this growth that takes place is a distortion of our energy. Rather, it is the essence of spiritual energy, which is pushing us to become everything we can possibly be. Whereas distortions of that energy manifest in terms of boredom or depression or just basically sleep or not caring about anything or anybody. And a spiritual manifestation of that would be to just be completely detached from anything, like I have no concern about anything anywhere. Then there are also other kinds of distortions which are less in ignorance and more in passion, like revenge or exploitation or greed or even simply violence. These manifestations are frustrations of the status quo. There are other manifestations of this problem, as in the desire for self-annihilation or a nihilistic kind of mentality. All of this, all of these manifestations are distortions of the pure energy of transformation. They are based upon false expectations. They are based upon too many demands upon the self. I'll explain that a little bit more. For false expectations, we expect that the world owes us something. We expect that other people owe us something. When they don't give that to us, we wish to take revenge on them, or we wish to exploit them, or to cheat them, because we know that they deserve it and we deserve to take. This is a distortion of our expectation that others should render service to us as we wish to render service to them. Often when we are children, we become very disappointed, or even perhaps in a previous lifetime, we become disappointed with the way people deal with us. And we manifest it as this enormous frustration, which comes out as violence or revenge or hatred. It is possible that each of these negative qualities of exploitation can be traced back to some very intense disappointment in a previous lifetime or a previous time. Now, you can also understand that depression, which is a very serious manifestation nowadays, can be traced back to extreme disappointment in oneself. The desire for self-annihilation or to somehow or another cause harm to oneself, as in excessive smoking, excessive drinking, eating all the wrong things or doing dangerous things with the body, can all be traced back to disappointment in the self. And this disappointment can be traced back to our feeling that we have not fulfilled the terms and conditions of the essence of our being as it manifests in this world. We have not lived up to the expectations of others. We have let others down. We have disappointed others. We have hurt others. We have placed others in a dangerous situation. All of these feelings can bring about great disappointment in the self, which can bring about enormous depression. Now, all of this is connected with something very, very good, connected to our essence. If any of what I have said is true, then that means all of the difficulties we have today are based upon our goodness and are not being able to deal with our acting in a way which does not fulfill the goodness that we are. The distortions come when we choose to react to our disappointment, or we choose to react to our feelings of insufficiency, or we choose to react to the negative emotions that all this creates within us with a negative reaction towards others or to ourselves. Where has this enormous guilt come from that plagues us into self-destructive tendencies whenever we are not perfect? Why can't we just accept our imperfection and be peaceful as imperfect beings? But that is very, very difficult to do. Some people deal with the frustration of not being perfect beings by working like mad their whole lives to attain that perfection. Others deal with that situation by becoming complete alcoholics or drug addicts of various kinds, just to forget about or to divert their attention to other aspects of life. One can accept addictions of any kind. There are thousands of addictions, to somehow or another divert the mind from the reality of our own imperfection. But the thing that amazes me the most is that we are all driven to perfection. We are all driven to become great, to evolve, to come to a great contact with and revelation of our spiritual essence. Everybody's dealing with it in their own way, yet everybody is dealing with it. And that's an amazing thing. Therefore, I feel that my particular role in this discussion is to make everybody aware of all of these distortions, which we consider to be so negative, are actually based in a highly spiritual principle of the desire for perfection. We all expect greatness from ourselves, even if it means something simple like being well-behaved or well-situated. Still, for us, that is the way in which we define that greatness in ourselves. We set goals in our lives. We set things we have to accomplish. We set ways we have to be. And when we don't get there, we become very disappointed in ourselves. And that creates a whole series of distortions in our lives. I would say ultimately, the greatest manifestation of simplicity in our lives would be when we stop demanding of ourselves so much, and we stop expecting of ourselves so much, and we just accept what we are, we accept what we have, and we just move one step at a time from wherever we are. And to see these demands that we feel upon ourselves, this pressure we feel upon ourselves, to be actually born within ourselves and not really externally powerful. And when we understand that, when we come to that internal conclusion, we shall actually attain peace within. When we stop being overwhelmed by these desires that push us towards a goal which may not be attainable in this lifetime, when we stop being victimized by the pressure we place upon ourselves by our self-expectation, and we just reasonably accept us as we are, then we have a possibility of peace, and not before. Let's see that point from just two different ways. When we were speaking about previously, the few weeks before, about darkness in the heart, these dark things that are in our heart. And when we open the door to these dark things and shine in a light, all of a sudden we see they're not very serious. They're not very ferocious. They're just things. And when one is condemning oneself for all of this darkness, which is not really so serious, it creates a distortion in the energy, which manifests as depression, for instance, we spoke about it, or it manifests as incredible anxiety or stress, which creates all kinds of improper actions. Or, let's say we are being pushed from any source, even ourselves. But the more we resist any pressures that come to us, the more these pressures persist. Therefore, peacefulness begins and is nurtured by our acceptance of what we are and the diminishing of demands and expectations upon ourselves. And the discipline is to take one step at a time. So I'd like to just stop the lecture here. We can take a little break if you'd like. And after that, we'll have some questions. And then at the end, we can do a meditation together. Are there any questions? Oh, here come. Yes, questions? Can you do by mic? All right. Hang on. Okay, they were asking, how do you basically reduce your demands and expectations upon yourself, or the pushing and desire to do things when the world or the circumstances around you are demanding other from you? They're demanding so much from you. How do you deal with that? How do you balance the situation of the internal need for peace? I'm amplifying his question now, with the demands of everything around you. Well, now, if I actually knew the answer to that question, I mean, honestly, if I had really the solution to that question, I would be the most famous person in the world today. Honestly speaking, for me, that is one of the greatest problems in my own life. Probably that's why I talked about it. For me, I'm a person who has great demands upon myself, and yet at the same time, I can also not have demands upon myself. I can also try to be peaceful and try to not be involved in pushing myself to do anything. But then there's the world around me which comes in and says, hey, We want to interact with you. We are suffering here. Can you do something about it? My particular characteristic is when somebody does approach me, or I don't mean just anybody, but I mean to say when a situation approaches me which I can do something about, there is this incredible burning intensity within me to do something about it. I'm not a kind of a person who feels very good about being complacent. So that pushes me. But there are many other things which push me. For example, maintenance. Just all of the hundreds of activities that surround maintenance. And sometimes you have to interact with other people in that maintenance. And in that interaction with other people, there's friction or there's problems which create lack of peacefulness. And then there's situations in the world where people find you out to cause you difficulty or to demand things from you or to want some kind of communication from you, even when you don't want to have anything to do with them. Sometimes even governments do that. And being peaceful or being, shall we say, freed from such expectations at such times is very, very difficult. Now, there's another problem which comes up. Let's say these situations come to you. And let's say you're trying to resist them or you're fighting them and everything. Well, that makes you even more agitated. You're thinking, I should be peaceful, I should be spiritual, I should not have to deal with this stuff. So you're frustrated, and your frustration reflects in your dealings with others. They reflect back their agitation to your frustration, which makes the whole thing boil up even more. So the way I deal with the situation, and I can't guarantee you that this is the best way to do it, I'm just telling you how I do it. I kind of just get into it on whatever level I have to, and just accept, now I'm into this situation, and I just live with it exactly as it is in front of me. But I do it with certain rules in my mind. Like, number one, I never threaten others. In other words, I don't try to get what I want by threatening their self-respect or their integrity or threatening their position in some way or another. I simply try to bring about what's this truth of the situation so that we can have a resolution. I mainly aim at resolution, not at trying to inflict damage on another. Here, I'll give you an example of it. I don't know if it's a very good example. It's just one that came to my mind. Previously, maybe 2 months ago, we were having a very difficult time with my internet connection. We were having a lot of disturbance in the internet line. And I was quite annoyed with the internet company, but I called them up and asked them to come over, and they were checking out the line. And the technician who came was very expert at the hardware aspect of it, but knew nothing about networks or about the way in which the signal's path would flow. And I was explaining that all to him, and he was becoming so interested that at the end, he didn't charge me for anything, even though he rewired something very significant in this house, which normally would cost a lot of money. So instead of entering into a situation of conflict where I would say, you people screwed me, you did all this wrong, I'm very upset with you, I entered into a situation of trying to assist this person, not only to resolve the situation, but to understand everything much more. And it all transformed in such a very favorable way. So this was my way of trying to deal with a potentially difficult, conflicting situation. And I'm not saying it works all the time, but I always try to give in such situations because somehow or another it always works out better for both parties. And in this way, I don't get so entangled, you know what I mean? So you can go through life working against others, which is like a constant friction, or you can go through life trying to work with others as your basic goal, and somehow working out all of the disturbances which confront you every day. It's just how you wish to see it and how you wish to deal with it. So I don't know if I actually answered your question, but as I said, I'm struggling with this question too, and this is the way I kind of deal with it the best I can. So I have here more questions from Kamala Mullis Flat. Continuing the issues of the previous session, I suppose it means the lecture, I would like to ask if we are choosing the problems in this life, does it mean that the ones who are choosing the biggest problems are the most advanced souls? In other words, the bigger the problems you choose to face in this life means you're more advanced. That's very interesting. Well, I don't know if you can say that. But certainly it does seem that those who choose such difficult situations are those who feel they need to go through these to advance. In other words, I don't know that you have to be advanced to choose troublesome situations, but I do know that overcoming these situations is the best way to advance. It's very hard to say, to answer that question in a very generalized way, because each and every one of us are different, and the situations that we face between lives when we make the decisions about what we will face in the next life are different and dependent on our positions. You can't make a general rule. And sometimes a very advanced soul may just be so tired from the struggle to advance even further, they may need a little vacation. That doesn't mean they're less because of it. They're just tired. We just started having a huge storm here, so I hope our connection maintains. The marvelous Florida hurricane season has started. The next question is, when one is in bad shape, meaning like sick or in bad economic situation, one can be in a bad energy which should influence the condition of the mind or could influence the condition of the mind. And since the condition of the mind is the main factor about where we go after death, does it mean that these bad situations can become the source of a bad destination after death? Again, in this situation, I feel that it very much depends on who the person is who this happens to and how they react to it. For example, I know devotees who've been very sick or in poverty who use that as an opportunity to gain liberation. Now, whether or not they get it, I'm not commenting, but it's an opportunity that is taken to elevate. There are others, like Jas Muheen, for instance, who had cancer, which was a sickness, who took that as an opportunity to develop her spiritual capacities to such an extent that she could become what she is today. So we do understand that there are, it is not a rule that these situations would cause negative reactions. So let's take it from the point of view of those persons who do have negative reactions from their sickness or economic condition. Now, when you take the sickness or poverty or catastrophe as an opportunity to hate God or hate others or be upset or be disturbed or to just really be angry at the situation, then you are creating a reactive consciousness which will absolutely affect you and your destination after death. After all, as you create your consciousness, as you have that energy within your consciousness, you cause a direction, you create a new direction, or you modify the direction of your life. And when you modify the direction of your life like this, it's your choice. Just as it is your choice to feel the way you feel about what is happening to you. But in all honesty, it's not really 100% your choice how you choose to react. There are many different factors involved. Let's say you get sick. Now, everybody reacts differently to different physiological conditions in their body. For example, severe cases of hypoglycemia have been linked to violent crimes by research, to violent crimes, to sexually deviant behavior, to all kinds of difficulties in a person's life. Hormonal changes in the body can drive one to become very upset, agitated, frustrated, to speak nastily, or to act irrationally. You can go on with hundreds of points from a medical point of view, but you get the point. The point is that when your body is causing certain difficulties to you, or when there's sickness within your body, it is not always under your control how you will react to it. And if your consciousness is affected by that out of your own voluntary will, it does not mean that this is going to create a certain reaction for you in the next lifetime, because it was not really based on your voluntary choice. But if you are, let's say you're somebody who has AIDS, and then you say, I have AIDS, I hate the world did this to me, I'm now going to go out and have sex with as many people as I can to give them AIDS, well, then you're using your body as a weapon, you are a killer. So in that case, it is very much linked to your choice. And the choice that you have made then dictates your future consequences. Now, sometimes poverty creates a very negative reaction in people. It can kind of like reduce all the good qualities in people because people become desperate in such a condition. And in such desperation, they may have to do things to survive which are ordinarily considered to be illegal or improper, which can create consequences. And yet, there are, for example, we have to see the reasons behind the behavior and not just judge the behavior as it is. There are no fixed rules. If you do this, you get that. There's a package of circumstances which create a package of consequences which are considered together, not independently. And again, the concept of punishment in the next lifetime for improper actions is a very limited concept. Rather, we understand the motivations behind our activities, the diseased mental or emotional conditions which create these activities, and these diseased emotional or mental conditions are what are addressed by circumstances in the next lifetime. And the whole point of the new situations in the next lifetime is to help us evolve beyond these mentalities, evolve beyond these kinds of qualities and characteristics within ourselves which cause us to react in a certain way. So I have not answered this question in a linear, yes, this causes that, yes, this causes that. That's too simplistic. It's unrealistic. It's not the way things happen, neither in this world, neither in the next world. Now, there's a further question in regard to this, that if one leaves the body in great pain, doesn't it influence the mind and influence the direction after death? I don't think so. After all, as soon as you leave the body, which was full of pain, there's an immediate relief. And that immediate relief is enough to just soothe all of the entangling conditions which were there at the point of death. It just like falls away. I know, for example, I've had some really bad headaches in my life. And when I have these bad headaches, I don't want anybody to talk to me, or don't have to do anything, because it's just too much pressure. It's too much. I crack up. But when I take some headache pills and the headache goes away, then immediately, oh, I'm back to my normal self. I feel badly about any of the particular ways I may have been when I was in my stress condition. And it's totally different. And if I had spoken badly to anybody, they immediately know when I'm finished with my headache. They don't say, oh, you were so bad. They go, of course you had such a bad headache that we don't even think about. Similarly, anybody who's of an evolved nature who would be involved in directing or assisting you after your death would not consider any of the pain that you had to go through when you were dying as a factor in any direction you would take afterwards. But there are situations in which the causes of that pain would be influencing us afterwards. Let's say we were so self-destructive of our bodies that we died because of the result of our own foolishness. We were in pain because of our own foolishness. After we die, we would think that, yes, I have to address the causes of this foolishness and correct that by learning something in my future existence. And because of that, yes, it does. And it can, let's say, it can influence our future after death. And then there's another question, which is, I would say, of a different nature. What is the real message of Lord Chaitanya for the modern world? Well, now, first of all, I would feel very uncomfortable to be so presumptuous as to claim that I know the real message of Lord Chaitanya for the modern world. But as I see it, I can explain how I see Lord Chaitanya's relevance in the modern world. As I've mentioned before, I see one of the major roles of Lord Chaitanya's influence is this very intense and widespread awareness of the requirement of every individual to balance the male and female energy within them, to become aware of the energies which they have so dedicatedly repressed for so long. As Lord Chaitanya is the perfect union of Radha and Krishna in one personality, as Swarup Dhammarai Goswami said, Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Radhe Krishna Nahayanya. Lord Chaitanya is Radha and Krishna combined in one person. So we have the perfect unification of the male and female energies in one personality. That is an incredible example for the world to follow. I see it that within each of us there is this male and female potentiality, that when it is out of balance, we become distorted in that particular direction. And balancing that energy requires to build up that part of us which is weak or deficient. And when we become fully aware of our own, shall we say, balanced and completeness as the composite of the male and female energy within us, we can then engage in spiritual evolution in a very solid way. Further, Lord Chaitanya showed us how living at that time, the spirituality at that time, was very much based upon the love, the loving relationships between people, the supportive, loving relationships between people. He had no church. He had no organization. He had no structure. He had no hierarchy. He had no demands. He was giving love to anyone causelessly, out of himself, because he was filled with love. He gave that love to everyone causelessly. It was a very natural arrangement where anybody and everybody could relate in very beautiful, loving relationships. Yet at the same time, there's another principle interesting about Lord Chaitanya's life, is that when he wanted to do something just for everybody, he went out and chanted or traveled, and that was for everybody. But when he wanted to do his own personal, private chanting, it was behind closed doors and only with those who had the same mentality and the same emotional evolution as he did. Because otherwise, he couldn't taste his particular way of being if it was mixed with others who were dragging it down. Sometimes there is this phenomena of the least common denominator, that when you have a large group of people, you have to speak to the lowest level upon which everybody can relate. Which means that everybody is stuck at the lowest level that is within the group. Lord Chaitanya displayed that when you wish to do that kind of work, you do it in a public way. But there should be always the private and elite or exclusive, not elite, wrong word, exclusive group where you are doing things which are satisfying your heart and your soul. And Lord Chaitanya was not at all into elitism, so sorry I used that word, for he would even go out and distribute prasadam to everybody with his own hand. The reason they stopped him was his hand was so big, he would give so much food, no one could eat it all. But he would still feel like that. He would still have that mood like that. There are hundreds and hundreds of examples that can be taken out of Lord Chaitanya's life and time, which are so relevant to the specific problems, especially the exploitation that takes place within spiritual organizations today. I think when I consider the deities in St. Petersburg and the way in which they relate to us, they are just very, very concerned that we come in contact with ourselves, and through that we learn how to contact them, that we balance within ourselves, become aware of ourselves, and come in contact with them, and then become their walking manifestations of energy, just like Lord Chaitanya's associates were. Even some who you came in contact with them, if the breeze passed by them, you would feel their spiritual energy of Lord Chaitanya. So I hope I have, to some extent, it's not possible in this short period, and it's not possible for me in general, to speak about all of the aspects of Lord Chaitanya's relevance in the modern time, but I just tried to give some that seemed to me to be the most relevant right now, but that doesn't mean that they are. It's just some things I thought of to answer the question. Now I've got this question here, how to balance the male and female energies within us. If you look on the website where we talk about the exercises and meditations, these exercises of balancing the brain with the ball back and forth and bringing in the energies on your predominating side, moving them to the weaker side, these go very far towards balancing the energies within the male and female energies within the body. And the more you become aware of the self, the more you become aware of your internal energy, the closer you will get to experiencing how your energy is out of balance, so that you will know which aspects of it to emphasize or to work on. And there's also another question here about the details about the moment of death. Is one seeing or hearing anything? Well, to a certain extent, there are general principles which can be discussed about that. There are detailed differences depending on who's dying and in which way they are dying. Now, if you think about it, we can analyze exactly the time of death first a little bit philosophically, and then we can get into an experiential description. Because the philosophical basis of it is that the soul, the essence, the energy of the living entity separates from the physical vehicle of that energy in this lifetime. And when that separation takes place, the struggle is causing the separation, because it's a tension. The connection is very deeply rooted, but due to the disqualification of the biological vehicle to hold the energy of life, it just separates. Just like when you have a can where the bottom, the can of water where the bottom is taken out, the water just leaves because the can is no longer qualified to hold the water. So when that struggle is over, because the question is relating to the moment of death, when that struggle is over, the natural response is to separate the two. As soon as the separation takes place, even slightly, there is a transformation, complete and utter transformation. But while the separation is taking place, there's a whole bunch of processes, you know, like you go down this tunnel, it seems to be, as your consciousness departs from the body and so on. But I want to talk about the exact moment at which the separation really takes place. Because when that separation actually takes place, then one's sensual capacity becomes incredibly expanded. However, what one can perceive has not yet manifested fully. In one's expanded awareness, one can see the surroundings around the death scene, so to speak, with great clarity and depth, far beyond the awareness during life. So one is immediately seeing the scene around, or hearing the scene around the time of death. That vision is what exactly one has at that moment. What happens after that depends totally on who you are and how you've dealt with your departure. It can either mean a short time hovering, or it can mean a long time hovering. But ultimately one gets to the point where one goes up to the light, so to speak, which is the realm where the next situation starts to unfold and manifest. Maybe an example of a blind person dying can help this understanding, because when a blind person is dying, they can't see. But as soon as they depart from the physical vehicle, then their natural sense of sight allows them to see entirely the scene around their death, because their blindness is associated with a neurological or whatever dysfunction in their physical body, which is immediately relieved when they depart from the physical vehicle. Are there any other questions? Because I've run out of written questions in front of me. Each of us has a little dictator within, a little fascist dictator that wants to put enormous pressure on us, wants to create an enormously difficult situation for all of us. It seems as if the dictators of the world, wherever they may have been in history, are actually a product of something which is inherent within all of us. This pushing of ourselves to be something which somebody else wants. Now, it's not even necessarily what we want when we sometimes push ourselves to be something. It can be what our parents wanted, or what society wanted, or what somebody else told us we should be. You're asking, who is that dictator? Is it our mind? Well, hard to say. It's a combination of elements within our consciousness that are pushing us to try to fulfill someone else's desires. But the main point is that we have to understand what we want. Now, I know that sounds kind of like simple, but it's the hardest thing in the world to know what really you want rather than what you are trying to fulfill that has been given to you by others. Other ideas, external ideas pushed into you by others. Understanding what you want as a person is a very tough job. It's something you have to really work at with and really carefully see what it is that you want that somebody else is wanting you to want and what it is that you want as a person. And until you do that, you can never understand who this dictator is or where this dictator gets its power from, because within your heart, it's a combination of so many energies, so many words you've heard, and so many ideals placed into you from the outside world. It's very hard to know what is you and what is something else. Physical time, Panchadara is complaining that he doesn't have the physical time to figure out what it is he wants. I disagree with that. I'm sorry. It is not something that requires physical time. It just requires incredible honesty and awareness that is not bound by time. That's an excuse. I don't have time to understand myself. That's an excuse. That's a rationalization to justify your fear of not doing it. So I thank you very much for your participation in the session today, and always for your support and for your participation in anything we are doing. For without you, none of this would be taking place. We're very grateful. I am very grateful to all of you for giving me this facility to be of service to you. And if you have any questions or you have anything, topics you would like me to discuss, please don't hesitate to email me or to instant message me at the time of the lecture, although it's much better to do it in advance. And I'll be very grateful for that. So wherever you may be, wherever you find yourself in life, I wish you luck and love and great success and prosperity and a good morning or a good afternoon, a good evening or a good night. And a goodbye to all of you. We're signing off of the broadcast. Thank you.